All right, Friday, 5 p.m. Time for American Radio, 90.3 WHP CHD, Garden City. I'm Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, doing this every Friday for ages and then some. And we're kind of back to normal, which feels good. Last week, we were doing a fundraiser, and that's not going to happen this week, I promise. The thing that's unusual about it is that we started a brand new series before that, discussing the career of Pink Floyd, and we're picking it up, part two. But it feels like there was a big gap. Well, there was a big gap in between because we had to skip that 1 week. But hopefully we can pick up exactly where we left off. And since it's only part two, all that we missed in the first show was really, really early history, if you didn't hear it yet, and songs that predated their first single, how they eventually became to begin to sound like Pink Floyd. Now we'll pick it up from there. So we talked about their live shows and how they were bringing in crowds. And it was due to the stunning success of their live shows, which combined lights and special effects and with psychedelic images and obviously lengthy musical improvisations in a manner that was previously unheard of, at least in England anyway. I mean, maybe San Francisco was doing stuff like that. And that might have been actually part of the influence for what was going on with the scene at the time. So the band found itself in the middle of a bidding war, which would eventually only to be signed to EMI. We'll get into that detail as we move through the show. So this meant that they would be working in the same studio as the Beatles in an adjacent room, recording their debut album while their label mates were putting the final touches on an album that would soon be titled Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So they even shared Norman Smith as their producer-engineer. Both the Beatles and Pink Floyd at their first album were using Norman Smith. And you might find this interesting. Norman Smith is the guy, if you know that song, Hey Babe, What Would You Say? It was Hey Babe. I'm not even going to try to sing it. But it was credited to Norm Hurricane Smith, and it was a top 40 hit. It was a really cute song. I didn't realize that was him. Anyway, this is a rather conspicuous and auspicious start for the band Pink Floyd. But the character that we really have to know to get this party started is Joe Boyd. When you think of Joe Boyd, I think these days, the last thing you think about is Pink Floyd. Joe Boyd is mostly associated with people like Fairport Convention and the like. I'm drawing a blank. Nick Drake, artists like that. Those were the people that Joe Boyd eventually, whose careers he helped start and became famous for. At this point in time, though, he was coming out of Massachusetts, came to London to try to do something to help. Well, basically, he was working for Elektra Records, and he came to find talent. And London at this point in time was swinging. This is like a pendulum do, as they say. And he was going to play a part in this counterculture life that was happening. So he got together with some of the people that were responsible for the shows that Pink Floyd had been doing in the other clubs, Peter Jenner, John Hopkins. We had mentioned some of their names earlier. And they started a company called DNA Productions. And they signed as managers for this group. The first people that they signed was a group called AMM. And they were this avant-garde jazz band that did very long improvisations. And the free jazz was basically something that the members of Pink Floyd were freaking out over. They thought it was the coolest thing. And they realized that what was happening there might have some sort of a use for what they were going to be about. So especially Syd Barrett, as he's watching the sax player and what he was doing. And he's saying, maybe we could be doing something like this at the same time. So DNA Productions, eventually the guy Hoppy, who was Joe Boyd's partner, left to join something called the London Free School, which was an anti-university and a community center that was to basically offer alternative education, that sort of stuff. So suddenly, Boyd would get involved in these type of things, and eventually he decided that he would open up a nightclub. Once again, this time in partnership with Hoppy. They became aware of the lack of a suitable venue for the development of underground culture. And the marquee where they were playing really wasn't like good enough, big enough for what they were doing. So they found a place, a bar that was a place called the Blarney Club, an Irish ballroom that was like sort of, that was somewhere on Tottenham Court Road. I don't know. But the room had a wide staircase, shamrocks on its walls, and all that sort of stuff. But they started by bringing Pink Floyd in as the main attraction, and they called it, like, basically it was the underground freakout scene. And the opening night was December 23rd, 1966, which they called the show the UFO Presents Night Tripper. And they played films by Andy Warhol that they brought from New York, and The Soft Machine played, and Pink Floyd played. So the initial agreement was for the club to be only on the two last Fridays of 1966. But after the success of their first events, they began to reopen their doors in January of 1967 in regularity. So besides Pink Floyd and Soft Machine, they'd bring in people like Crazy World of Arthur Brown, the Grand Bond Organization, Procol Harum, bands like that, even 10 years after. But it was Pink Floyd who were mastering the art of using the lighting system that they had and playing with the idea of stretching songs out. And they became like the totemic group for the club. And it became incredibly popular. As one like member of the audience once said, "I'd lie down on the floor and they'd be up on stage like supernatural gargoyles." And the same color that was exploding over them was exploding over us. It was like being taken over, mind, body, and soul. The thing is, the problem is the band became, but the club, UFO, became a victim of its own success. It was too small over time to deal with the ever-increasing crowd that was coming. So, and eventually, the owners of the premises had to cancel their lease, and they had to move. And that whole thing, and they closed their doors for good in October. Now, in the meantime, Boyd, though, had very strong interests in being a producer for Pink Floyd. So he was responsible for getting them involved with the movie soundtrack songs that we played last week that was playing in the background, which gave them a start. Then he said he was going to record a single that he would use to get them promoted to, like I said, he was there because he was working for Elektra. And he figured if we record a good single, we'll get you signed. The problem was the guy who ran Elektra, Jack Holzman, totally disagreed with Joe Boyd. And he hated Pink Floyd. So he wasn't going to sign them at all. So Pink Floyd decided that he would settle and maybe become their manager. He would become their producer. He would make their songs. And you know, whatever label they went to, so be it. So it was Joe Boyd who brought them into the studio and set up his own production company, which he called Which Season Productions. And he produced, with Pink Floyd, of course, the group's first hit, or the first single. And its name was Arnold Lane.
Arnold Lane had a strange hobby, collecting clothes, moonshine, washing lime. They suit him fine. On the wall hung a tall mirror. Distorted view.
Oh, a nasty sort of person.
You know, that's a true story. It sounds funny, but that's a song about a fetishist who steals, like, women's clothing from washing lines and stuff. Well, the inspiration for Arnold Lane came from a real-life incident. Then Roger Water tells the story. These are Roger's words. My mother and Sid's mother had students as lodgers. There was a girls' college up the road, so there were constantly great lines of bras and knickers on our washing lines, and Arnold, or whoever he was, had bits and pieces off our washing lines. They never caught him. He stopped doing it after a bit when things got too hot for him. So that inspired them to write the song about somebody who steals women's clothing from from the washing line. Now, as I mentioned, it was Joe Boyd who was responsible for that production. Meanwhile, though, Peter Jenner and Andrew King are managing the band, and Boyd is trying very hard to get them a contract. But Jenner and King, meanwhile, are, because he couldn't get them signed to Elektra, but they said, we definitely want you to produce them, because obviously he's a fabulous producer. You listen to Arnold Lane, and that's an obvious hit, right? He's fantastic at what he does. And he already had some success with other bands, but they had to go to other places, and they ended up going to EMI. And there's obviously no doubt that Joe Boyd wanted to keep his relationship with Sid Barrett, Roger Waters, Rich White, and Nick Mason. But when they took the song that Boyd had produced to EMI, they ended up siding with EMI. And EMI themselves had no patience for independent record producers because they were EMI. They owned Abbey Road. They didn't need to bring in outside producers. Now, they wanted to use their own man, Norman Smith, Norm Hurricane Smith, who I was just talking about earlier, because he had been engineering the Beatles, and that he would therefore become, once they signed to EMI, he was going to become the producer for Pink Floyd. So, goes, this is Nick Mason now. He recalls basically having to say that Peter Jenner was given the unenviable task of telling Joe Boyd that even though it was his work that got the band signed, he was essentially fired. And now Jenner and King and Nick Mason look back at it, and they say, this is the quote, the alacrity with which Peter and I left Joe standing was shameless. Probably true. I mean, this is the guy who had already produced The Incredible String Band. The Hangman's Beautiful Daughter is an album that is still considered incredibly classic. Went on to record Fairport Convention's albums, Lesion Leaf, Unhalfbricking, Nick Drake's Five Leaves Left, Brighter Later, and bands like Fathering Gay. And he did a lot of great work, but very, very different from what Pink Floyd would become. Here's the B-side of that Joe Boyd produced on the same day that they recorded Arnold Lane. They recorded this song called Candy and a Currant Bun.
See you around and link that. sitting in the sun. Go by and the end of current fun. I like to see you run.
At the time, there was a lot of conversation about what song should be the A-side, whether it should have been Arnold Lane or Candy and a Currant Bun, which is obviously a very commercial song. I think that if they were going to put Candy and a Currant Bun on the A-side, it also would have been maybe just as effective because it's an obviously incredible psychedelic song, and Sid puts his heart into it. You got to keep in mind that at this point in time, Sid Barrett is still living with his mother. You know, at home, they're still mostly really kids trying to, you know, get well known, but it's working because now they are on EMI. They're literally at this point in time now, after this record is done, now they are belonging to EMI, and they start going to EMI studios to record their songs, which means that they end up literally working in like Studio C, which is down the road, right down the hallway from where the Beatles were in the main room. Recording Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. When that happens, you know that you hit the big time. Oh, another funny like side story about Candy and a Currant Bun. I should mention this. The A side, Arnold Lane, got banned in England by Radio London and Radio Caroline because they just figured it, I guess because of the sexual connotations that were there. They would have totally banned it if they didn't change the name of Candy and a Currant Bun. It was originally called Let's Roll Another One. But they decided that, okay, if we're going to get banned, we're going to be forced to change it. So instead of drug references, the drug references instead became Sweet Treats. Candy and a Currant Bun. So there it is. That brings us to them now recording with Norman Smith, who I had mentioned before, at Sound Techniques, one of the studios and the works that was getting done. And at this point, on May 12th, 1967, Pink Floyd played a concert at Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, known as Games for May, and billed as a moment of, quote, space-age relaxation for the climax of spring. It had electronic compositions, color and image projections, Girls and the Pink Floyd, as it was booked. Girls and the Pink Floyd. I'm sure there was a big turn-on for a lot of people to go to the show. The gig had been organized by Jenner and King with the blessing of a classical music promoter named Christopher Hunt. It was a crucial stage in the group's development. It allowed the group to test out new compositions using a quadraphonic sound system specially designed by EMI's engineers, which, by the way, was stolen after the concert, so that was gone. According to Nick Mason, this was, quote, one of the most significant shows we have ever performed since the concert contained elements that became part of our performances for the next 30 years. So they already didn't know it at the time, but this is exactly where they knew they were going and where they stayed for three decades. That takes us right up past Dark Side of the Moon, and then some, takes us right up to the 80s. In the absence of a first part, the Pink Floyd would create stage effects to their own taste, taking into account the fact that the crowd would be seated, which was relatively unusual for a rock concert at the time. So, on the set list for the show were 10 or so songs, plus a number of tape recordings. Sid even composed a song especially for the event, and he named it Games for May, since that was what the name of the show was. Eventually, Games for May would be knocked around a little bit, and it would eventually become the song See Emily Play, and that was going to be the A-side of their second single. Here's See Emily Play. Thank you.
but misunderstands. She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow. There is no sound till tomorrow. Touches the ground. Float on the river forever and ever, Emily.
Emily.
There is no other day. Let's try it another way. You'll lose your mind and play. Three games for me.
Rather interesting song lyrically. And the question always was, who is Emily? This woman who tries but misunderstands and is often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow. Roger Waters just said, could be anyone. He really didn't know who it was. But at the time, so a lot of people said, well, okay, Who Cries After Dark, it was a product of Sid's obviously fertile imagination, a young woman who actually appeared to him among the trees during an acid trip when he was taking a walk in the woods. He's already taking way too much acid, daily base at this point in time. Jenny Spires, who was a girlfriend of Sid's at the time, said that Emily was Sid's favorite first name for a woman, and that if he had a daughter one day, he would name her Emily. Well, regardless, See Emily Play did reach number 6 in the UK on July 29th. It went top 10, only being really prevented from going any higher because this was the Summer of Love. And the Beatles' All You Need Is Love was on the charts. And Scott McKenzie, like, if you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear flowers in your hair. So these are the songs that kept See Emily Play from reaching the top. Every A-side has a B-side. And in this instance, the B-side is a song that would actually, it's the only song from the first two singles that actually made an album. See Emily Play was not included on their debut album, and neither was Arnold Lane or Candy and a Currant Bun. This B-side of See Emily Play was a song called Scarecrow, which is, if I'm... But you know, I'm reading from Pink Floyd, All the Songs, the story behind every track. It's a rather interesting book that goes into maybe too much detail in some ways on a lot of the songs. But they call Scarecrow an absolutely superb example of Sid Barrett's imagination at play, of his bucolic inspiration that was a legacy of his Cambridge childhood. In this song, he presents not a gnome out of the pages of Tolkien, nor a rat from The Wind of the Willows, but a black and green scarecrow with a bird on his hat and straw everywhere. The song draws a disturbing analogy. The black and green scarecrow is sadder than me, but now he's resigned to his fate because life's not unkind. He doesn't mind, which is what Sid sings. So what does that mean? That the scarecrow is really actually Sid? Maybe. Could be. Or maybe that he is detached from the world? It's all possible, one way or the other. So just before I play it, let me remind you that you are listening to WHPC, WHPC HD in Garden City, New York. The show is American Hit Radio, and we are here every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6, talking a lot about music. That's what we do. And there we are then. We can play the B-side of See Emily Play. Here is the song Scarecrow.
And green scarecrow, as everyone knows, stood with a bird on his hat and straw everywhere. He didn't care. He stood in a field where barley grows. His head did no thinking, his arms didn't move, except when the wind cut up rough and mice ran around on the ground. He stood in a field where barley grows. The black and green scarecrow was sadder than me, but now he's resigned to his fate, his guy's not unkind, he doesn't mind. He stood in a field where barley
All right, so they've got two, I would say, fabulous singles under their belt. Singles that to this day remain incredibly, retain their integrity incredibly well. Arnold Lane and See Emily Play are songs that are they're lauded by just anybody who's a fan of rock and roll. And the B-sides are also quite remarkable as well. Now it's time for them to make an album. And the thing is, the band still consider themselves to be a live band at heart. And they were still performing at clubs and other venues wherever they could do lengthy psychedelic improvisations with these elaborate lighting effects that they were using. In early 1967, Pink Floyd played something like 20 gigs at places like the Marquee, the UFO Club, and the Commonwealth Institute, gigs that could probably easily be described as multimedia, and that, in a way, resembled the acid tests things that were taking place in California that the Dead and Jefferson Airplane were doing. This was the British version of that, sort of. Roger Waters would say, "It's definitely," this is his quote, "it's definitely a complete realization of the aims of psychedelia. But if you take LSD, what you experience depends entirely on who you are. Our music may give you the screaming horror or throw you into screaming ecstasy. Mostly it's the latter. We find our audiences stop dancing now. We tend to get them standing there, totally grooved with their mouths open." So they start recording the album. This is like after the Beatles had released Revolver, and maybe the first progressive song that came off of that album, Tomorrow Never Knows, sort of set the mood for what Pink Floyd would be capable of doing. And of course, the Beatles after that released Strawberry Fields Forever with Penny Lane, and the Stones were doing, you know, were working on Between the Buttons. The Doors' first album had come out, The Birds, Younger Than Yesterday, Jefferson Airplane, Surrealistic Pillow, but not quite. Let's see. Jimi Hendrix, who was going to be releasing Are You Experienced, maybe could have gotten the title, but maybe probably deserves the title. But a lot of people consider Pink Floyd's first album to be the quote-unquote the first progressive rock album. It was like the psychedelic era had come. And it was like a spaced-out reinterpretation of the blues and a soundtrack to acid trips. It's pretty much, it's like, in a sense, rereading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is as one person put it. And it's songs like this that pretty much make that astonishingly clear, not only for its style, but because of the unusual length of the song. It's a bit long for a pop song in 1967 when it came out. It is entitled Astronomy Domini.
Yeah.
obviously it's another song written by Sid. Sort of a dark, like a bad trip sort of a song. A galactic journey that takes us to Jupiter and Saturn and Oberon, Miranda, Titania, Neptune, and Titan. As it says in the notes here, Barrett evokes a fight between the blue you once knew, stars that can frighten, and icy water is underground. It's pretty scary. But he is, like, you know, not only talking about space, but he's, you know, references to astronomy and also Shakespeare, like Oberon and Madonna and Titania. Those are the moons of Uranus, where Oberon is also the king of the fairies and all that sort of in Midsummer Night's Dream. So this is, you know, Sid was being rather creative in going to a whole bunch of different sources to come up with his psychedelic stuff. But now they are working in Abbey Road. And we've got to talk about, like, the people that are responsible for this. Norman Smith, I mentioned a few times, and Phil May, who was the singer for The Pretty Things, and who also worked with Norman Smith, was talking about the band. And in his eyes, he said, it was hard working with Sid Barrett and Pink Floyd in particular, but Roger Waters in particular, because he was such an egoist. I mean, the minute he could get rid of anybody who was doing anything in the Floyd, he would. Roger wanted the Floyd for himself, but Norman Smith wasn't part of that scenario, he said. And if there wouldn't have been Norman Smith, the Pink Floyd wouldn't have existed. Well, they wouldn't have been able to develop what they were trying to do, because there was nobody who had the ears that Norman had. But he wasn't alone. There was a second member who was the sound engineer, Peter Bowne, an incredible character, a florid gay man in his 40s with a Beatle fringe and a jovial disposition coupled with an extraordinary ear, a man whom George Martin himself called an electronics wizard. He came from the classical music scene, but he was at this time one of EMI's balance engineers. He was one of Norman Smith's mentors. A senior engineer, Bowne taught Smith the art of engineering when Smith was just starting out. And more than any other engineer at EMI, he was always trying out new equipment and looking for unconventional ways of combining pieces to make new sounds. Andrew King, who talks about, you know, the same man, says that he saw him as someone who was eccentric, to say the least, someone who painted his nails with a coat of plastic because, quote, the faders on the console were wearing his fingers out. He was so conscientious that he would have no hesitation in positioning himself in front of a drummer for minutes on end in order to listen to the precise sound that was being emitted before trying to reproduce it in the control room. So the Pink Floyd had a perfect team to help them show what they were capable of doing. And let's get to a second awesome track from the first album. Well, we can. I can stop talking to play a song. This one is another Sid Barrett composition, of course, like everything that we've heard up until now. They've all been Sid Barrett compositions. This one is entitled Lucifer Sam.
By your side, always by your side. That cat's something I can't explain. We'll be right back.
I never really knew the lyrics of the key hook of that song, and I know it now. It's "That cat's something I can't explain." Cat. And it's interesting because is he talking about a cat or is he talking about a person? The song was originally supposed to be part of a soundtrack for an animated film called The Life Story of Percy the Rat Catcher, and they were going to supply the music. But the project fell through. It didn't happen. So they eventually changed the name around to Lucifer Sam. With the most likely explanation is that Syd Barrett was inspired by something that he had read called Dick Whittington and His Cat to express his affection for his own cat. Thus, lyrics like, "Siam cat, always sitting by your side. That cat's something I can't explain." Or, he also mentions a witch, which is maybe another like song that he had picked up from a 15th century called Riddles Wisely Expounded. But there's yet another. Syd also could be alluding to a psychodrama that actually played out between some of his friends when one of them tainted what the other one was drinking with acid, and he was not ready for it, and he had an incredibly bad trip. So that could have been where Lucifer Sam came from, because Sam was a friend of his whose name was Ty Sam, who was renamed Lucifer Sam in the song. So, oh, you're the one that basically caused this person to almost lose his mind. You're Lucifer. So that said. Now, the next act, you'll realize how much of this, though, is based upon literature that Syd is reading, and almost all of the literature that he's reading and that he loves so much are like children's books. The next song, Matilda Mother, reveals Syd Barrett's fascination with children's songs and tales. In this instance, he draws on the imagination of a writer named Hilaire Belloc, an Anglo-French writer who is best known for writing a book called Cautionary Tales for Children. Among them, Matilda, who, quote, told lies and was burned to death. It's a tale that Syd's mother would read to him as a child in their Cambridge home. Syd loved the book, and in his initial draft of the song, he reproduced the lyrics entirely from the writing of Hilaire Belloc. And these were the lyrics. "And finding she was left alone, went tiptoe to the telephone and summoned the immediate aid of London's noble fire brigade." So that was how the song was supposed to go, but they weren't Syd's words. He lifted them. But the band said, well, what's wrong with that? We can do anything we want to do, right? We're just writing a song. Well, they had to get permission. And Hilaire Belloc's right holders were absolutely not. There's no way that he's going to get affiliated with a bunch of drug-taking hippies who are starting a whole new psychedelic culture. So they had to change the words. Syd had to like write new words entirely, but still kept it as a sort of a childhood song involving a king, a scarlet eagle, you know, just Syd being Syd, a little bit fantastical. Here's Matilda Mother.
Thank you. alone in the clouds all blue, lying on an eiderdown. Yippee, you can't see me, but I can you. Blazing in the foggy dew, sitting on a unicorn. No fear, you can't hear me, but I can you. Watching buttercups cup the light, sleeping on a dandelion. Too much, I won't touch you, but then I might. Streaming through the starlit sky,
okay, I owe you an apology, because my entire intro was for Matilda Mother, and I forgot that I put that song aside because I knew I wasn't going to be able to make the entire thing together in 1 hour, and here I am talking about it anyway. We'll play that. I'll open next week's show with Matilda Mother just to clarify all of that. But the song that we just played is called Flaming, which is obviously yet another song about Sid and his childhood, about, you know, basically nursery rhymes. Lyrics like all alone in the clouds all blue, lying on an eiderdown. Yippee, you can't see me, but I can you. This is so Sid. It's just so perfect. He's this like childlike wonder at this point in time. But that brings us to another song that would have fit in, well, if I had put Matilda Mother down, but I guess I'll play it next week. This song is called The Gnome. It's around the same time that he wrote Lucifer Sam, which we played earlier, Matilda Mother, the song that I neglected to play, Flaming, which we just played, and Scarecrow, which was the B-side of See Emily Play. All of these songs are like childhood memories that would like haunt Sid. Memories of like what for him was like in Cambridge, Grant Chester Meadows, nursery rhymes, and reading authors with these imaginations that would inspire him not only to write the songs, but to take more LSD, to see the characters that he is like beginning to imagine. In this song, it's about a little man, a gnome named Grimble Grumble, with a scarlet tunic and a blue-green hood, who had a big adventure. Of course he did. This might be our last song. Maybe not, it's a short song, so we might be able to tell you what. We'll do this, and we'll let it segue into the tune, Chapter 24. And we'll see you next week with the remainder of the best bits of Pink Floyd's first album. See you then, folks. Sorry for that blunder.
I want to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome named Grimble Grumble, and little gnomes stay in their homes.
scarlet tunic, a blue-green hood. It looked quite good. He had a big adventure amidst the grass, fresh air at last. Whining, dining, biding his time. And then one day, hooray, another way for gnomes to say. Isn't it good? Look at the sky, look at the river. Isn't it good? Winding, finding places to go. And then one day, is accomplished in six stages, and the seventh brings return. The seven is the number of the young light. It forms when darkness is increased by one. Going and coming without a run. Action brings good fortune. Sunset. In six stages, and the seventh brings return.